King, that is what makes him a hero for our day, because he never backed down. He never gave up on his true beliefs, and he continued to insist even when it would have been a lot easier for him to step back.
Jonathan, I want to thank you for this interview and hope you can stay for us to do a post-show interview. We'll post it at democracynow.org to talk about King's early years and the allies he was forced to sever ties with for a time, like Bayard Rustin. We're talking to Jonathan Eig, longtime journalist, author. His new biography is out, King, A Life. That does it for our show. Go to democracynow.org for all transcripts of show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland teachers rally for smaller class sizes, better working conditions, and more. A hotter-than-normal summer is likely on the way for Oregon. And in national news, an abortion doctor is fined for helping a 10-year-old rape victim. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, May 30th. 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. In addition to barbecues and outdoor fun, Memorial Day around our area is marked with events to honor and remember those who have served our armed forces. The 142nd Wing of the Oregon Air National Guard conducted flyovers yesterday that saw flights above Veterans Memorial Park in Beaverton, Calvary Cemetery in Mount Angel, North Plains Veteran Park, and City View Cemetery in Salem. The flyover also included Willamette National Cemetery in Portland, where a ceremony yesterday morning saluted those military members buried on the site. Another special service to honor Vietnam veterans took place at the Oregon Vietnam Veterans of Oregon Memorial in Washington Park. Down in Salem, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs also held an event of remembrance at the Oregon World War II Memorial on state capitol grounds. Memorial Day was first declared a national holiday in 1971 by an act of Congress to honor all of those who have given their lives in American wars. Contract negotiations between the Portland Public School District and the Portland Association of Teachers are heating up. Last week, teachers demonstrated in support of their union's request for smaller class sizes, racial equity, restorative justice, less testing, and expanded mental health services. KABU's Isabel Charlet is an educator and union member, as well as a reporter. She filed this report from last week's rally.
More testing! No race! No contract! No peace!
Hundreds of educators and their supporters gathered outside the PPS board meeting last week to demand better pay, working conditions, and learning conditions for students. The teachers' union, Portland Association of Teachers, has been in contract negotiations with the district since January. And with the board getting closer to their final vote on next year's budget, energy is picking up. This is an educator speaking about the particularly rough conditions faced by teachers and students of color at Ockley Green Middle School in North Portland.
In addition to the facilities being unteachable, they cannot learn in these facilities. They have rats. They have carbon dioxide. Ockley Green is crystal. Teachers are leaving. Teachers of color don't want to be there. And kids, 77 kids have left this year because it is unsafe. Please, love on our kids. Support teachers of color.
The school board says declining enrollment, paired with the follow-up loss of funding from the state, makes many of the changes the union is asking for challenging. But the president of the PAT, Angela Bonilla, says what they're fighting for is fundamental.
No mold and rodents in our buildings, temperatures between 60 and 90 degrees. We're asking for class size caps and caseload caps so our educators don't keep leaving the district because it is unsustainable. We're asking for mental health teams post-COVID in every single school. So it seems like if they don't have the money, we gotta find the money. And yet, every time I hear about school safety, I hear, we will find the money, we will figure it out. So we have the money to bring, you know, armed guards into our schools, but we don't have the money to make sure that we have mental health professionals to avoid those types of incidents. Make the math make sense, right?
The board did recently approve a 2.5% pay increase for cost of living, but union members say in order to keep up with inflation, educators need an 8.5% cost of living increase. This is an educational assistant, or EA, who spoke at the rally. To begin, the crowd squeezes inside the PPS administration building, which is quickly filled beyond capacity. We are told that some of us need to leave to avoid violating fire codes. Some of the teachers I'm standing by joke that it's ironic that now the school board is concerned about the numbers of people in a room being a safety hazard, when they don't seem to show the same concern for class sizes.
Yeah, I mean, at our school, in my program in particular, at my high school, over half of our students are on IEPs or 504s, and we have zero paraeducators in our program to help with that. And these kids, you know, they need a lot of support. And when you're the only adult in the room and you have a classroom that is too full of students and half of them need extra support, there's only so much learning that you can facilitate.
Martha works at Pacific University training teachers and also has two children at PPS.
And as a researcher that focuses on the strategies of how to create better school systems and understands policy and educational policy, it's disappointing that they also know the information that I know and they choose to do the opposite, right? A bunch of the teachers that were here are teachers that I've trained myself, and beyond that, I know their hearts, and I know that they have loved on my children, so how could I not support that? How can I not support them?
Next year's budget is likely to include the layoff of 90 PPS employees, a 3% staff reduction, but the union is not giving up.
But what we saw last year is that when we speak up and we speak out, positions do get renewed. They found money to support our middle schools and provide more support last year for this year. So we're hoping that this advocacy will push them to spend the money we know they have on the things we know we need.
For KBOO News, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio made headlines when she was forced to cross state lines to get an abortion. Now the doctor who assisted her is being fined by the Indiana Medical Licensing Board. Joe Ullery has the story.
An Indiana licensing board has fined a local physician $3,000 and handed her a letter of reprimand after she went public about a 10-year-old Ohio patient forced to travel across state lines for an abortion. Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita brought the case against Dr. Caitlin Bernard for comments she made last July to the Indianapolis Star about a young rape victim who could not legally receive an abortion in Ohio because she was just over 6 weeks pregnant. Bernard testified she did not feel she would have ever been brought before the board where she risked losing her license if Rokita had not chosen to make the case a political stunt.
I feel an obligation as a physician to share information that is relevant to public health, as well as potentially in light of certain legislation, ensuring that it is clear that those are contrary to the best interests of my patients.
The AG's office had argued Bernard made the decision to speak about her patient to the largest newspaper in Indiana, which resulted in national publicity for the case. Indiana University Health, where Bernard works, issued a statement after the decision, maintaining its findings that Bernard did properly follow privacy laws. After the story broke, Rokita appeared on Fox News to discuss it. Other Republican leaders, including Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, suggested Bernard fabricated the story. Bernard acknowledged that politics made the case more challenging.
Certainly, there was a lot of media frenzy. I was receiving significant harassment, particularly after Fox News picked up on the story and began featuring the story in their news segments. I was quite surprised by all of the attention.
Bernard told the licensing board she was surprised that people think young girls are not, unfortunately, frequently raped and become pregnant. I'm Joe Ullery for Indiana News Service.
Weather experts are predicting a much hotter July and August for our state as the region shifts to an El Niño weather pattern. According to Oregon State researchers, the naturally occurring pattern associated with cooler ocean temperatures will move to the warmer El Niño phase, which is the planet's most powerful natural climate model. This transition doesn't normally impact our region until late summer, early fall, or even winter, but everything will depend on how fast the El Niño develops. Long-timers will note that over the last decade, Oregon's summers have already been warmer and drier due to climate change. Now, scientists are concerned we might see the warmest El Niño pattern ever. That's due to the rise in temperatures as a result of increased greenhouse gas emissions and other causes of global warming. The fire season may also start later than typical because of that wet spring and lots of snowpack. But that isn't necessarily good news. Ironically, the cooler and wetter than usual spring we experienced this year could also cause a longer fire season. Oregonians already have experienced more intense wildfires as well as extreme heat and drought over the last few years. Erica Fleischman is the director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute and a professor at Oregon State University. She says the state needs to prepare for extreme heat. Some solutions are already planned, including regulations to protect workers laboring in high temperatures, establishing more cooling centers, and offering heat pumps to households in need. She also recommends the state do more to revise building codes and plant trees, as many communities are disproportionately affected by high heat. There are also several bills in Oregon State's legislative session aimed at lowering greenhouse gas emissions. However, the current walkout by the state Senate Republicans could put them on indefinite hold. President Biden honors those who have served our country on Memorial Day. Former President Trump retakes the lead in a new GOP primary poll, and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is impeached. With more on those stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
On this day, we come together again to reflect, to remember, but above all, to recommit to the future our fallen heroes fought for.
On Memorial Day, President Joe Biden delivered remarks at Arlington National Cemetery and laid a wreath honoring fallen service members. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also spoke. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy are working to convince their caucuses to pass legislation to codify their agreement on raising the debt ceiling. Republicans got some, but not all, the spending cuts they wanted, some of which will extend for a decade. North Carolina Representative Patrick McHenry called it the most conservative spending package of his time in Congress.
The difference between our perspective and their perspective is enormous. So for us to draw them down and actually have spending restraint year over year and within a Congress is truly transformational.
The Supreme Court will soon announce decisions on student debt relief, affirmative action, and the Voting Rights Act in a case focusing on an Alabama dispute over when states must draw minority-majority voting districts. California Democratic Representative Katie Porter said Americans' confidence in the Supreme Court is at a record low and is among a growing number calling on the Supreme Court justices to be held to a code of conduct after conservative justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch have come under scrutiny over financial disclosure.
The problem is not that the Supreme Court is just conservative. The problem is that it's corrupt.
According to a new survey by the University of California, Berkeley, former President Donald Trump has retaken the lead from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis among likely California Republican primary voters. The survey found 44% would support Trump, while 26% would support DeSantis. Over the weekend, the Texas Republican-led House of Representatives impeached Republican State Attorney General Ken Paxton over allegations of bribery and abuse of public trust. Texas Representative David Spiller was among one of the Republican members of the committee who brought forth the articles of impeachment.
No one person should be above the law, least not the top law enforcement official of the state of Texas.
Under Texas law, Paxton has been temporarily removed from office pending a Senate trial. Paxton responded to the impeachment saying corrupt politicians in the Texas House are demonstrating that blind loyalty to Speaker Dade Phelan is more important than upholding their oath of office.
They have denied me the opportunity to present the evidence which contradicts their politically motivated narrative, and they are showcasing their absolute contempt for the electoral process.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, For the Wild. Your weather tonight will be cloudy with a chance of showers and a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow, a mix of clouds in the morning and sun in the afternoon with a high of 70 degrees. Today in history, it was on this day in 1989 that the 32-foot-high Goddess of Democracy statue is erected in Tiananmen Square by demonstrators in Beijing, China. The quote of the day is from Mel Blanc, who was born on this day in 1908 and gave us the voice of Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, and many others you know from old Saturday morning cartoons. Mel said, quote, "When I was a kid, I used to look at animals and wonder how would that kitten talk? I tighten up my throat and make a very small voice, not realizing that I was rehearsing." Washington State is moving closer to its goal of seeing that all Washingtonians have access to broadband internet service by 2028. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
State grants could bring high-speed internet access to nearly 15,000 Washingtonians. The State Broadband Office is awarding $121 million to 19 projects largely designed to ensure broadband for rural communities. Director of the Washington State Broadband Office, Mark Vasconi, says an even greater number of communities will need to be served after this round of grants.
We received over $300 million worth of requests. So I think that shows the need that's out there. And frankly, we were glad that we were able to award the projects that we did.
The state has a goal of ensuring every Washingtonian has access to 150 megabits per second speed internet by 2028. According to the latest FCC broadband map, 93% of Washingtonians have access to internet with speeds of at least 100 megabits per second. Vasconi says internet availability will equalize access to services for the people who live in Washington.
You have access to services, access to information that you otherwise would not have. It's really essential in order to conduct your daily life, whether that be healthcare information, educational information, banking information.
Funds are going to counties and electric co-ops, as well as the Spokane Tribe, which is receiving about $3.4 million. The state is funding the project with investments from the Federal Coronavirus Capital Project Fund. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Coeur d'Alene tribe and the Spokane Riverkeeper organization have reached a settlement with a company that was dumping dangerous runoff into a tributary of the Spokane River. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Advocates for clean water have reached a settlement with a North Idaho business over stormwater that's discharged into a tributary to the Spokane River. Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports.
CHS Incorporated deals with transporting fertilizer and agricultural chemicals. The company was found to have violated a stormwater permit by allowing runoff that contained excessive sediment and minerals such as copper and zinc to flow into Rock Creek, a tributary of Hangman Creek. The Coeur d'Alene tribe and the Spokane Riverkeeper told the company they plan to sue, and after negotiations, a settlement was reached. Spokane Riverkeeper Jerry White says CHS agreed to modify a basin where the stormwater is collected. The company also agreed to put $152,000 into a fund that aids Coeur d'Alene tribe environmental projects.
Coeur d'Alene tribe is doing amazing work and will do amazing work with this fund to actually intercept and stop pollution with the creek restoration they're doing up above this facility.
White says the work will help benefit Chinook salmon and red-band trout. Both types of fish were hurt by the sediment and minerals in the plant's runoff. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
A Cochiti Pueblo artist is showcasing his latest work at a museum in Colorado, using contemporary art to blend historic events with futuristic elements. Emma Van Den Einde of the Mountain West News Bureau has more.
The year is 2180. The New Mexican Pueblos are under attack by Spanish invaders. Two leaders in metallic combat gear, Omtua and Katua, are going to each pueblo to share the news about an uprising. That's the premise of Virgil Ortiz's Revolt, 1680-2180, Runners and Gliders. The new exhibit at Denver's History Colorado Museum blends augmented reality and futuristic fashion with more than 800-year-old pottery. It's an artistic expression that's based on the true story of the Pueblo Revolt of 1680.
It's America's first revolution, but it's not called that or taught that because of the bloodshed.
That's Virgil Ortiz, the lead artist on the project. His ancestors told him about the tribal runners and how they coordinated the revolt against the Spanish using knotted deer hide.
At each pueblo, they dropped up a knotted cord to all the leaders, and they instructed them to untie one knot every morning. So on the day when the last knot was untied, then all the people rose up and pushed out the invaders.
Experts call it the most successful indigenous uprising in North American history, even though it's been rarely taught in schools.
I'm trying to educate globally about what happened to our people, the atrocities, the bloodshed, and eventually the peace that came after it, but using art.
But this isn't your average exhibit. It explores the concept called slipstream, where events in the past, present, and future are occurring at the same time. Ren Batista modeled for the exhibit.
I've got this awesome silver crocodile skin pattern chest piece on with a spiky sort of headdress coming out of the back, and it's all very sci-fi and transformative.
The exhibit also features a projection room with colored lights, indigenous symbols, and characters searching for artifacts. Batista says the layout of the exhibit shows that indigenous history transcends time.
That heritage has survived on despite the violence, despite the colonialism against them. And so to see it finally being socially relevant, to see voices like Virgil's being highlighted by history centers is such an awesome turn of tides.
For National Native News, I'm Emma Van Den Einde.
Tune in tomorrow for part two to hear how the exhibit has made an impact on visitors. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. is walking a fine line when it comes to supporting Taiwan and maintaining a positive relationship with China. Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov offers his global citizen commentary on this issue. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. A few weeks ago, I reported on the worrying signs of a large gap in communications between the U.S. and China. Since then, some high-level contacts have resumed, notably a long meeting in Vienna between National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Wang Yi, who is China's foremost foreign policy official. Then President Biden, at the close of the G7 meeting in Hiroshima, signaled that ties with China would be improving very soon. But does resumption of contacts promise serious engagement? They're not the same things. And unless contacts address the critical areas of disagreement and mistrust, they will be photo ops and nothing more. U.S. officials have a long road to hoe to convince Beijing that they want to engage in serious business. First, there's the bipartisan consensus in Congress that is intent on decoupling from China economically, academically, and militarily. Then there are the determined efforts of the Biden administration to deny China access to semiconductor technology and the latest computer chips. At the Hiroshima meeting, Biden convinced the other G7 members to join that policy, now labeled de-risking rather than decoupling. Predictably, China condemned the policy as amounting to containment and efforts to thwart China's development. To be sure, some long-standing issues will remain frozen for some time to come. Human rights in China, a U.S. ban on technology exports to China that may have military applications, a major change in the uneven trade balance that favors China, the U.S. alignment of several Asian countries in groups that aim to deter China, and most of all, Taiwan. None of these is an easy fix, but when it comes to Taiwan, the core of China's core interests, as Xi Jinping has put it, mutual understanding and reassurances can be effective substitutes for a final settlement. Those can come none too soon. Here's why. On May 19, one of China's most eminent America watchers, Professor Jia Jingguo of Beijing University, gave a talk in the U.S. that listed all the areas of Chinese government concern about U.S. policy. U.S. interference in Taiwan, as the Chinese see it, occupies center stage, Jia said. He pointed to three pledges on Taiwan going back to the Nixon era that the U.S. has violated. First, to regard Taiwan as part of China. Second, to terminate a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. And third, to withdraw troops from Taiwan. His reference is to visits to Taiwan by senior U.S. officials, such as former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, thus upgrading Taiwan's independent status, to recent statements by Biden promising defense of Taiwan if China attacked it, despite the defense treaty's abrogation, and to expanded U.S. military aid to Taiwan that includes training of Taiwanese forces. Professor Jia mainly blames the U.S. Congress for these provocative moves. So, he said, under these circumstances, China is rethinking its strategy of peaceful reunification. He makes some good points, but U.S. officials deny these Chinese charges. They insist the U.S. still upholds the One China principle, still adheres to strategic ambiguity when it comes to the question of defending Taiwan, and still provides only defensive aid to Taiwan. But Jia Jingguo's words are ominous because they come from a longtime advocate of U.S.-China engagement. He is suggesting that in the view of some influential Chinese, the U.S. is drifting toward endorsement of Taiwanese independence. That would be crossing China's red line. China has never forsworn the use of force to take over Taiwan, but until now it has always proclaimed that peaceful reunification is Chinese policy. Now, says Professor Jia, there is a rethinking. Equally ominous is Jia's caution that China's nuclear policy, which includes embracing the doctrine of no first use of nuclear weapons, might change if the pressure on Taiwan continues. He pointed to some Chinese who are now advocating a policy change that would, among other things, support providing nuclear weapons or delivery systems to friendly countries, in the same way that the U.S. has promised to provide nuclear submarines to Australia. We are already aware that China will be adding to its nuclear weapon arsenal, moving from the current 400 or so weapons to over 1,000. These two potential Chinese policy changes, toward unification with Taiwan by force and toward a more offensive nuclear posture, would dramatically increase tensions with the U.S., thus entering into a new Cold War. As Professor Jia pointed out, however, the U.S. emphasis on strategic competition with China omits the possibilities for cooperation. And those are right before us, issues of paramount concern to each country and to the planet, and issues that can be the building blocks of positive relations: climate change, pandemic research, military-to-military relations, robust people-to-people exchanges, and yes, nuclear weapons reductions. Xi Jinping is on record numerous times for proposing a list of cooperative projects that includes all these issues and more. He has also called for a U.S.-China joint statement of principles that would provide a guideline for cooperation. That's the direction we should be heading. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 30th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Michelle Coppola, Josh Salem, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Michelle Coppola, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez, Joe Ullery, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
Contact. Making Contact.
On today's Making Contact, we commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, when more than 700,000 Palestinians were violently displaced from their homes. Nakba means catastrophe in Arabic. It's generally understood as the events that started in late 1947, but the ongoing Nakba also refers to the current displacement and oppression of Palestinians